This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Welcome to the Counter Narrative Podcast, a show designed to change the way we talk and think about education. By sharing stories of successes and triumphs, we aim to challenge the dominant narrative that often negatively portrays our disenfranchised populations. I'm your host, Charles Williams, an urban educator for more than 15 years, a current school principal in Chicago, an educational consultant, an equity advocate, and the co-host of Inside the Principal's Office. Let's get started. In this episode, I chat with Joshua Stamper, the training and development specialist for the Teach Better team and the manager of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Prior to his current position, he was a middle school administrator, classroom art educator, and a coach. Josh is also the author of Aspire to Lead, podcaster, a leadership coach, and an educational presenter. During our conversation, we talk about behavior and the role that it plays in our educational systems. All too often, we forget to acknowledge and understand that language is a behavior. And when our students do not comply with the expectations in our spaces, it is their way of asking for help. How do we respond? Well, let's take a listen to Josh and hear what he has to say and some suggestions and recommendations. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Counter Narrative Podcast. As always, thank you for rejoining us in the space and joining in and tuning into these shows. If this is your first time, welcome. Welcome to the space. I hope that you enjoy the episode. If you do, feel free to go and check out the rest. But again, if you are rejoining, just thank you for being in the space, because I think this is going to be a great episode. I know you're already thinking, and I've said this, right? Charles, you always say that, but I'm excited because I have somebody on this show who I've been able to share space with for quite some time. He's a fellow educator, a fellow author. We run in the same edu space together. And in fact, he has allowed me and helped me to grow into that space a little bit more. And I'm sure he has done the same for many, many others. So I am bringing on one of the Teach Better masterminds, especially in the podcast area, Joshua Stamper. Josh, how are you, sir?
Charles, I am wonderful. Anytime I get a chance to spend time with you, it's a good day.
Oh, well, thank you, sir. Now I'm blushing, even though they can't see it. So Josh, like I said, you know, when we were chatting before, you know, I'm glad that I have you on the show. You've helped me to get this show, is to be part of the Teach Better Network. The work that you do, you know, helps to grow and market and things like that. And not just for me, but for a lot of other podcasters out there. So before we jump into the episode, why don't you tell us a little bit more about who you are? It's very possible somebody listening to this is like, I don't know, Josh. I don't know this Teach Better thing. What are they talking about? And then I'm like, they've been living under a rock. So we really got to talk to them. But tell us, who are you? What do you do?
Well, of course, I'll try and enlighten those who haven't heard about the Teach Better team, but it's a phenomenal group. I am the training and development specialist for them. They've been in existence for 8 years, just a fantastic, marvelous, just passionate group of former educators who created a business to help teachers with their instruction. And so we run what's called the Grid Method. It's a self-paced student program, and I get a chance to travel around the country and work with a lot of different educators. My specialty is kind of around restorative practices and trauma-informed care, but then I also do like a ton of other things with the team, including an administrative mastermind that's free for administrators every Tuesday morning. I work on video. I work on podcast network as the manager there for that space. So I have my I don't know, I have a lot of roles on the Teach Better team, but prior to that, I was an administrator. Oh, goodness. Sorry about that, Charles.
No worries. it's real life. So, right? This is who we are.
I have 6 kids and 3 dogs, so it's bound to happen on a podcast, right? So as far as before being a training development specialist, I was an administrator for 9 years as an assistant principal of a middle school. Absolutely loved it. Got to be administrator for multiple campuses, multiple districts. And really my passion during that time was on what I speak with. And then, of course, working with schools now is around, you know, trying to change the viewpoint of student discipline and on restorative practices specifically. Before that, I was an art teacher, if you can believe that, and a coach. I know that's a weird combination, but did that for about 6 years. And then before that, I was a paraprofessional with special education as I was trying to get my teaching license. So I feel very blessed that I've kind of got to see many different roles in that educational space, which each one was extremely valuable in teaching me something. And of course, now I get to spread my wings a little bit more and help folks all around the country.
I'm trying to imagine an art teacher / coach like those. If you were able to design your own jerseys, those must have been something.
I actually, every campus I was on, I had logos and a lot of design work that I did. I actually was a graphic designer before being a paraprofessional, getting my teaching license. So I always love that, you know, type of stuff. So I did t-shirt designs and all kinds of stuff. I had stuff on my desk, you know, even as an assistant principal, I was still doing that. So yeah, it was, I mean, if you could build a perfect like combo for myself and my interests, that was it. So it was really tough to go into administration once I had those two roles, because it was so fun. I felt like I had obviously my own space in my own classroom, but then I also got to impact so many other lives, and I absolutely love sports.
Nice. I have a few ideas. I might have to pitch something to you. You know, it's always like, I'm like, yes, I could see it. And then I sit down on Canva and I was like, why won't it happen?
Yeah. Well, anything you need, buddy, you just let me know.
I appreciate it. So, you know, obviously you've spent time in a variety of spaces we've talked about, right? You've been in the classroom, you've been an administrator, and now you're in a space where you're not, you know, in a school each and every single day, but you are still pouring in, you're still supporting and growing this work that we do. So, you know, coming onto the show, I'm curious, what area do you want to talk about? Where do you want to push back? Where do you want to present a different idea?
Well, I think with restorative practices and trauma-informed care, I think that was kind of my biggest battle, if you will, on the campus, just because of just the viewpoint of folks. I think the experience of a lot of teachers was I was successful in school, and so I didn't really get in trouble. And what my experience was just detention, ISS, OSS, and they want to just continue those practices. And as we all know, school looks very different now, and the experiences that our kids have gone through is very different. And a lot of times the behavior that we're seeing and that's being exhibited is got an underlying story. And instead of just, you know, slapping a bandaid on it and throwing them in a room and expecting magic for them to change their behavior once they get back to the classroom, you know, my charge was like, no, let's invest in them. Let's teach them the appropriate ways to, you know, regulate their emotions, work through stressful situations, you know, how to combat, you know, communication and, you know, adverse situations. So, you know, there was a lot of things that I was trying to work against. Unfortunately, I had kind of like a 50-50 split of folks that, you know, really understood the reality of things and wanted to do something different, even if they didn't know what that looked like. And then I had another that was like, you know, ready for corporal punishment and, you know, write down something on a piece of paper 1,000 times, you know, very
punitive.
Traditional, yeah. Like I said. Yeah, very punitive. Or like kick them out of class, get rid of them, you know, send them back into the community. So, you know, I think that's just something that was really difficult in all of my schools that I was in, where I felt like I was kind of beating my own drum, trying to get folks to understand that there's more to that story.
Well, I'm glad that we're having this conversation. In my building, we're big on restorative justice practices. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I just had, so instead of having like disciplinarians or even deans for at each grade level at the high school, we have an RP specialist, a restorative practice specialist,
yeah,
for every single grade level. And this past year, I sent them to trainings so that way they could become certified, you know, in this area, because right within the district of Chicago, this is a big movement. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The number of people who truly believe, the people who buy in, is not always as big as it should be. And so I know you kind of mentioned earlier, a lot of times these educators, they were good at school, right? They weren't necessarily great students. And I always say this, they were just good at school. So yeah, right? They weren't getting in trouble. They weren't having issues. They just kind of knew what was happening to those other kids.
Correct.
So do you have any, like, why else might people just be like, no, like, we've got to come down hard. And you know what I hear all the time is that the issue with restorative practice is there's no consequences, right? And I'm like, that's not the case.
But no.
Why do you think there's that's such a prevalent mindset?
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to what you were talking about with like the experiences of our teachers. I had a group come in with, and really it was for positive interventions. They came in and they did this activity with our entire staff. And so in our cafeteria, we had like four different levels. There were steps. And they said, if you've never been to the principal's office, go to the lowest step. If you've been to the principal's office once, go to the second step. If you've been there three times, go to the third step. And if you've been there more than five times, go to the top step. And 95% of the staff went to, I've never been to the principal's office. And then, of course, it trickled up, you know, and unfortunately, I was on that top step.
I was going to say, where were you, Josh? Where were you?
Yeah, I'll be transparent with your audience. I was on the top step. What was funny was the principal and myself, as the assistant principal, were both on the top step. So I think we had a little bit more compassion. And obviously, we were, you know, pushing that charge as far as understanding, you know, that for us growing up, you know, we did have trauma in our life. There was things going on that was a cause of our behavior, because behavior is a language. We were screaming for help. It's just nobody was listening. And so that's what I wanted our staff to understand, is that, you know, our kids are telling us something, but are we just trying to push and cram down information and trying to get through the standards, which, don't get me wrong, that's why they're there. But again, if you don't have student discipline in your classroom or on your campus, then no learning is occurring. So we really need to figure out what the symptoms are, you know, just like a doctor, right? Or if there's another metaphor, is the dam, right? If the dam is breaking, you're not going to stick your finger in the hole. I mean, you're going to figure out why it's cracking. You're going to actually work on the foundation. And that's what, you know, I want to do with my students. And that doesn't happen overnight. It takes a lot of time. And as you know, I'm kind of jealous. You're talking about restorative practice folks for each grade level. I would kill for that. You know, resources is such an issue, especially in Texas, with restorative practices, that we were having to pull on a lot of different spaces to create those restorative circles and do some of that creative stuff. So anyways, I would just say that, you know, for most people, and to answer your question, I just don't think that they truly understand, because they haven't gone through it as a child, as a parent. And then as a teacher, I just don't think they have the patience, because there's so many other stresses on their life, to really sit down and work on student behavior.
I really like the idea that you said, you know, this idea of compassion, right? I've never been to, so therefore I don't understand.
Correct.
And I remember at the beginning of this year, or I guess at the beginning of the last school year, I was brand new to a brand new school. And one of the things the principal had mentioned to me, he said, you know, we're really struggling with the concept of restorative practices. Mm-hmm. And so I remember, you know, we talked about kind of like ACEs and PCEs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tied it to restorative practices. And it was that idea that, you know, we all have experienced some sort of trauma, but those of us who are quote unquote functioning, right, if you will, you know, have often more than not had these PCEs. And then, you know, it was kind of like, look how restorative practices plays into these. And it, you know, it was building that, like, oh, like, maybe mm-hmm. that's why, right? Like, if we, you know, we can be preventative. In fact, I had closed that out with, like, we're going to be we have the same amount of time in the building, right? The same amount of time in the class, the same amount of time in the year. So we could either be preventative and pour in and build these relationships, or we can fight back and address all the behavioral issues. Like, regardless, like, we're spending that time. Like, how do you want to spend your time? So I like the fact that you brought up about compassion.
Yeah, I think empathy is with that too. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, believe empathy is a weakness. And that's not the case. I mean, we have to understand, and compassion falls right in line with that. I mean, there are so many times, and we did this activity with our staff, is we would just put a student's story, no name, no information about who it was, just this is a person in our building. This is a kid that's going through this scenario. And it was just slide after slide after slide. And the amount of people that were gasping, there were tears at the end. And it wasn't to make them feel guilty. It was just to enlighten them that our kids are walking through the hallways and we just fill in the gap. There are puzzle pieces that we'll never see. There's things that are going in their world that maybe they only share with a trusted adult or a counselor or administrator, and nobody else knows about it. And we just can't assume that they're just bad kids. Like, that's not what it's about. Our kids are not bad kids. We, you know, in every campus I was at, we had phenomenal, phenomenal students that had so much potential and are just doing amazing things. And the growth that we saw, but unfortunately, whenever there was a gap that we didn't know about, just, and maybe this is human nature, is we just filled it in with the negative. And what I was always trying to let our staff know is, like, you got to have positive intent. You got to fill that blank with a positive, and it changes your outlook completely on the ability of that child and what they're going to become.
So I'm curious if we could dive into a concept, and I alluded to this earlier, and one of the reasons why, you know, at the end of school this year, you know, we had two students who were in the hallway, right? They were not where they should have been, and they were with a peer who, you know, who made a pretty poor mistake. Sure. And so, you know, those two students, they take off running, right? Security like catches them. And so I sit down and I chat with them. You know, I go through the video footage, and sure enough, right, they were not involved. They were just, they were in the hallway, right? And that was their quote unquote, like, infraction.
Right.
And so I said, all right, well, how are we going to repair this harm? Right. Because you're upset with the security, you were cursing at them. And, you know, they're like, well, yeah, but they're always on us. And I was like, well, let's think about this, right? Like, you weren't where you're supposed to be, right? You kind of have a history. And they're like, no, you're right. You're right. Right. And so I was like, let's make this, you know, let's fix this. So one of the pushbacks that I immediately got, and it wasn't even the security guard who was involved, it was somebody else who were like, well, see, this is what we talk about. There's no consequences. They should be sent home. And I said, sent home for what? For being in the hallway? And so I want to, you know, because I'm sure there are people listening to this right now and saying, you know, I hear what you're saying, right? Yes, it's important to love on them. Yes, it's important to build relationships. Yes, 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 yes. But, right, where are the consequences? So in your experience of working through, like, restorative practices and trauma-informed schools, like, what role did consequences play, or how would you respond to somebody who had that pushback?
Well, I'm smiling ear to ear because this is like a daily occurrence on my campus, and even working with schools right now, that is like the number one question. So what it's about is defining what a consequence is, because often what consequences are viewed as, it's punishment. It's, how am I going to hurt the child for them to not do it because of fear? And if we really were to break it down as simplistic as possible, is that really the best way to teach our kids? And if we define it that way, most people are like, no, I don't. Because if we as parents did exactly what we did in schools, so for instance, like, let's say my two boys, which probably happens daily, you know, get into either a verbal or a physical altercation. If I stuck them in their room for 8 hours, that would be insane. Mm-hmm. Like, no parent would do that. And no one viewing that as the consequence would think that's logical. However, in schools, we do it every single day.
Absolutely.
So why is it acceptable in the school, but not for our own kids? There's a disconnect there. So, you know, for me, it's like redefining what consequences are. For some child that has done something wrong and comes into the front office, or, you know, an assistant principal or principal's office, that experience alone is a consequence that will last forever, and they'll never do that again, and they'll never be in the front office. Tears come down, just the fact that they have to have their parent called, you know. So a consequence of sitting down with an administrator or, you know, a dean of students, the person that they wronged, and to work out that situation, I view that as a consequence, because a lot of students, shoot, a lot of adults don't even possess those skills or would want to go through an experience like that. And for them to go through 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour to repair the harm that was done, create an action plan, apologize to whoever it was that they hurt. I mean, that alone, I think, is potentially the only consequence or additional consequence that the child would receive. And so it's just really just trying to change the mind frame of that word and the experience and understanding that consequences look like a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. So what is it that we can put in place that's actually going to teach the child not to do that again, and teach them who it harmed and how to repair that? Because that process alone is going to teach them how to be a better adult versus just sitting in a room hanging out, or, like I said, writing sentences, or, you know, doing a book report in silence. I mean, there's better options for our kids that are actually going to be beneficial than just killing time.
You know, you mentioned a few things there, right? I mean, one is the idea of, like, how can I learn and grow from this, right? We're a school. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many times I've seen those slides or you know, heard the quotes like, you know, if our students are struggling with reading, we teach them how to read, right? If they're struggling with math, we teach them how to do math. But if they're struggling with behavior, like, we punish them. Like, we wouldn't punish a child for struggling to read or to, and right, behavior is exactly that. Like, you know, I don't know how it is in your building, but, you know, in my middle schools and high schools, kids tend to be like 6'4" with beards.
Oh, for sure.
So, you know, they
I'm the shortest one in the eighth grade hall, man.
Right. And, you know, we tend to think of them as adults, you know, but we forget the fact, like, you know, that brains aren't really fully developed right until like the mid 20s. So here you are with a child who's in their teens, right? Even when they graduate high school, right? They're 18, 19. I mean, you might have a 20-year-old, but, like, at the end of the day, they're mentally, right, psychologically, they're still underdeveloped children. And yet we expect them to act like adults. But as you pointed out, what we're asking them to do, most adults can't even do, right?
Correct.
It's a challenge for us. That and punishments are a lot easier, right? It's kind of the way out. Like, I didn't know it was an option when my girls would get into a fight to be like, oh, I'm going to suspend you. Go stay at your grandma's for one day.
Like, wait, that's an option? I can do that?
Like, wait a minute. All the parents are like, wait a minute. Nobody told us about this. Like, we heard about detention, going to your room, but suspensions was a thing?
Right. Yeah. No, totally. I think we just... It's very easy to see a kid that, like you said, has a beard, looks like they are married with three kids and are going to drive home. But the reality, even, you know, sixth, seventh, eighth, even high school, we can't assume that they possess the skills to, one, communicate about their emotions or even understand the emotions that are going through their mind. Like you said, the brain development of some of our adolescents is the same as a two-year-old. It's incredible how much growth, especially in middle school, that we see, not only physically, but in all aspects. That's what I loved about middle school, was that you could easily see the growth in every facet of their life, you know, in athletics, and band, and art, all these different avenues, math, right? That they're just sponges. They're just soaking it all in. And then you can see just the beauty of such rapid growth. And so, you know, the same goes with what you were talking about with instruction. We have 1,000 instructional strategies that we provide in every subject, and we don't give up. We have all these tools in the toolbox, but then when it comes to discipline, all we want to grab is the hammer. We just want to hammer the kid. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, if you're a carpenter, you're going to have a lot more tools than the hammer. The hammer isn't very effective in a lot of different things. And so every kid's different. They've gone through many different experiences. And so why doesn't our discipline matrix, or the people that are working with, you know, these students, try unique and creative ways to, again, teach the students how to do a little bit better?
So I'm wondering if you could share with us, right? And I'm was sitting here thinking, you know, the countless potential stories, right?
Sure.
Because I'm sure somebody's like, okay, I hear you, but like, is it true, right? So do you have, you know, an example that pops into mind where like, yeah, we could have, right? We sure. could have pulled out the hammer, for example, right? To drill in a screw, we could have pulled out the hammer, but instead, right, we took a tool that was appropriate for the situation and implemented it, and this was the outcome. Like we didn't have to go that punitive route, and we still had a positive outcome. Do you have an example that you could share?
Oh, for sure, Charles. Yeah, like you said, I have probably 1,000. The first one that popped in my head was I had a young man that came in for the book fair. It was being run through the library. It was a fundraiser for our librarian and, you know, getting additional books. And he came in and he stole a book. He took the book, stuck it under his jacket, walked out. Librarian saw him, caught him, brought him right to my office. Now, if we were to do the traditional route, I would have thrown him in ISS for 3 days, called his mom, let him know what was going on. So instead, you know, talking about restored practices. So what I did instead was I took the student, I asked the librarian, hey, is it okay if we do a restorative circle? And I didn't do it in my office behind the desk. I did it in a conference room. There was a table for us to circle up. And so what I asked the student was to just explain like why he took the book. And it was to show off to his friends. He wanted to look cool. He had the money. It wasn't an issue of him stealing because he didn't have the funds. So he explained that to the librarian, explained what he should have done instead, how it was wrong. He apologized to the librarian. Then it was, okay, what is the action plan? What are you going to construct to repair the harm? This was his idea. We did not prompt him. He said he wanted to volunteer for 2 weeks before school and to be like the secret shopper so that no one else could steal at the book fair.
Hmm.
And then he'd also, if there was a downtime, help the librarian to put books on the shelves. Librarian agreed. I called his mom. She was actually ecstatic because she didn't want him just sitting in a room for 3 days, which she just assumed was going to be the consequence. But she actually loved the idea that he had to wake up early, that he built the plan, that he apologized. And I mean, the kid knew he shouldn't have done it, but he did anyways. So he did. He served his 2 weeks. And the relationship between him and the librarian was powerful. In fact, after his consequence, he actually would go in during his lunch. After he finished lunch, he'd ask me if he'd go to library, and then he would just help her out and shelf books and talk with her. And they built a strong relationship over those 2 weeks because the librarian realized it's not a bad kid. It's a kid that made a mistake who is now willing to help her and her fundraiser and whatnot. And it was such a powerful moment to see that relationship grow. And what's the alternative? I throw him in ISS for 3 days. That relationship is broken between him and the librarian. The mom's upset about the school is punishing her son in this way, thinking that there's a better option. The student doesn't learn anything as far as repairing the situation or communicating or apologizing. And, you know, I think because of the creative way that we were able to do that in the restorative circle, it was a 1,000 times better result far as the person, right? We're focusing on the person and building these skills. And it's something I know that he'll remember for the rest of his life.
You know, and I think the idea there, right, is what is the goal, right? What is the objective at the end of this consequence, if you will, right? Like, well, we don't want him to steal a book again. And it sounds like the pathway that you all took almost ensures that. Right. If you build that relationship, well, I don't steal from people. Right. And I used to tell this to teachers all the time. One of the biggest reasons why we build those relationships is because we tend not to harm those we love. Right.
Yep.
So if I have that relationship now, then I'm going to be less likely to steal a book as opposed to, like you said, on the other route, like now that that's been damaged and I don't care about you. In fact, maybe I'm going to do it again just to spite you. You know, so I'm glad that we looked at those two different pathways.
Well, and that happens with the teacher-student relationship all the time. And that was one of the things that we were trying to fix. It was a broken system. Is a teacher would send a student out, student would be upset with teacher. teacher would, or the student would come down to the ISS room, spend their time there, would see an administrator. The administrator would build that time with that student to try and understand what was going on. So the relationship between the administrator and the student was being strengthened, yes, as the student and the teacher relationship was being weakened. And then once they served their consequence in ISS, they would go back to the environment that they were just removed from. They were kicked out. They were not welcome. And that relationship is still broken. So what do you think is going to occur moving forward? Mm-hmm. What you said, there's spite. I'm going to do everything I can to make your life miserable because you don't like me. It's obvious. You kicked me out of class. You've shamed me in front of my peers. You know, fill in whatever negative thought that correlates with that. And it's no surprise that that behavior continues. And then it's just a cycle. Student does something to anger the teacher. The teacher kicks them out. Then they come into the administrator and that relationship gets stronger. And now there's jealousy from the teacher to the administrator because they have a wonderful relationship and they don't understand why. Well, the why is because they are the ones spending all the time together and the administrator is getting to know the student and feeding into that relationship. And what is lacking is the fact that the relationship needs to be stronger between the student and the teacher.
Man, I wish I could like capture that and share it. And I was like, wait, we're literally recording a podcast.
Like, we're doing a podcast. No, like, way.
Yeah. I have a tool here. It's just everything that you just said, you know, rings true on so many different levels. And, you know, seeing, you know, to take that step back and to recognize that process, right? And I get it's easy to do when you're not involved or when you're clear-headed, right? It's easy to take that. But in the moment.
Oh, and sure.
You know, is something that you mentioned is this is not a quick thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it takes time. We had to sit down. We had to have that circle. We had to develop a plan, right? We had to flush it out. And I think that's one of those key factors is that this type of approach, it takes time. Right. Yep. These are not just gut responses. That's where those handbooks and the matrixes come in, because it's easy to just say, well, this happened. This is the outcome. Right. But
correct.
That shouldn't be the approach. And so I'm curious then for those listening to say, OK, I hear you. Maybe I'm kind of like on the fence now. Right. I was in the yard. Now I'm on the fence. What might be.
That's progress. I'll take that, Charles.
You're right. It's something. So to get them a little over, like, what would you recommend, right? Either maybe it's a resource, someplace where they could learn and grow in some more in this area, or B, what are some practical things, right? This, we're in the summer, but I come back into the school, right? It's day one because we know things happen, right? Or maybe it's day two, right? And that kid messes up. How should I respond as a teacher? What are some practical things that I can do, you know, to kind of lean into the restorative practice mindset as opposed to the punitive mindset, or a combination of those two things, right? Resource and practice.
Well, I want to at least share a strategy that we implemented to combat what I just was talking about in regards to the teacher-student relationship. Because like I said, in Texas, we didn't have a lot of resources. We had to really lean on each other. So once we understood that there was a problem, we then had to recognize that the trauma was actually hurting the campus and the culture, right? So what was our response to that? And so the response was, first off, we wanted the teachers and the students to have a better relationship, you know, after an infraction. And thankfully, you know, over time, we got our staff to that point where they agreed. So we did, and this was something that, you know, all educators do. We stole this from another campus in another state, which was a push-in, is what they called it. And this was calling a counselor, an administrator, coach, someone that was trained to go in to a situation that could be highly volatile or emotional and be able to calm the situation for the student and the teacher to have an opportunity to walk and talk through what was going on. And again, this is low level infraction, right? This is what you would call like a level one infraction. This isn't like two kids brawling in the classroom. But a lot of times what we found in our discipline data was that a lot of kids were getting sent out for disruptions and smaller behaviors. So if they called an administrator to come in for a push-in, the push-in was for the administrator to go into the class and take over the lesson at that point, so that then the teacher and the student can go and do kind of like a mini circle, or really it was like a walk and talk, to get out of that environment so that there wasn't people staring and being in their business. It would allow the teacher to show, you know, that empathy, trying to find out what was going on, that compassion component, and then strengthen that relationship. Because that was the thing, was that we were just lacking time. Like you said earlier, it's easier just to kick, get out. It's harder and it takes more time and effort to actually spend, you know, additional time to get to know what's going on in that kid's life. So we found a lot of success where our referrals went way down. Our student time went up as far as in classrooms, because again, this was an opportunity for that relationship to be built and stronger. So that way the student understood that the teacher really does care about them and wants them to stay in the educational environment instead of the opposite, which is the negative of, oh, they kicked me out, they hate me. So, you know, that was one of the things that we implemented that didn't really take a lot of resources, although it did take time, which is a resource. But as far as money and like additional staffing and whatnot, that was one thing that we implemented that was, that changed the culture of our, and really the discipline went way down because of it too, because we were being proactive in that instead of just, you know, again, kicking kids out.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting, right? When we think about those parallels between academics and behavior, like the MTSS triangle, you know, and it's that tier one area. Yeah. Right? We do so much work in academics to say, hey, we're going to try to capture as many. And I tell people, like, on the other side of that with the behavior, it's being proactive. You know, mm-hmm. tiers two and three are responding to situations, but there's so much that we can do, right, to be proactive and to develop those spaces. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, of course, man. And you asked about resources too. I had my entire staff multiple years go through TBRI through TCU with Dr. Professor Purvis. She's passed away, God rest her soul, but she did some amazing work, and the campus continues to do work with trauma-informed practices. So all of my teachers went through a free program. A lot of times they'll provide it for educators for free on their website. And I think when we did it, there was like four modules and each were like an hour. But our staff was so thankful to get that information, because it's one thing for me to get from the staff as an administrator and tell them or teach them.
Right.
It's another to have someone, you know, that's doing the research and has really spent her life, you know, working on trauma-informed care. And, you know, it's trust-based is what this is all about. So she typically is working, her research was for foster students or foster kids in that space. However, there were so many parallels, and I was one of these folks. This changed my outlook on administration and discipline completely going through the program as a foster parent. But, you know, they saw that it's not just for foster kids. Like, trauma is going through our entire country. I think it's like 70% of all people in the United States go through one ACE or one form of trauma. So, like, you know, if it's that prevalent, then these skills should be known by everyone in education.
And I'm sure that number is going to increase, especially in all this post-pandemic stuff. Like, it's...
Yes.
Yeah. And speaking of resources, I was thinking about a resource, you know, that exists. I believe there's a book. It's like Aspire to Lead or something like that.
That is a resource I've heard about. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to give you space. I know people are like, wait, why is he like casually throwing it out there? Aspire to Lead is, you know, is Josh's book. And so I do want to give him an opportunity, because maybe somebody listening to this episode is like, maybe this Josh is onto something, you know, I want to learn a little more about him. Like, there's a resource. You pick up his book, you could, you know, learn and grow a little bit more. So Josh, tell us a little bit about the book and where they can find it.
Yeah. Well, you can find the book pretty much anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart. But as far as the book goes, it's kind of just my charge as far as being an art teacher to administrator. And I do talk about myself as a student and just how I hated school and just couldn't stand it, and really tried to have just this relationship piece intertwined. But it really is a guideline, a guide to not hit those landmines, if you will, in educational leadership. I mean, becoming an art teacher was phenomenal, but when I got tapped on the shoulder by an assistant principal saying I needed to become an administrator, I almost fell over on the floor because I just wasn't expecting it. And so unfortunately, as an elective teacher, I had a kind of the stigma of what that role is. And a lot of times that wasn't viewed as someone that could lead a building. So I just kind of, you know, talk through, you know, all the trials that I went through as a teacher, because if someone's going through that track right now and is listening, you're probably been told you're going to the dark side. You know, you've probably had some other nicknames. Mine was Golden Boy. You know, the administrators supposedly loved me so much. So, you know, I could do no wrong in the staff's eyes. So the relationships and things that I thought were instilled, you know, changed dramatically as soon as they viewed me as a bad guy, if you will. And so I just kind of walked through my journey, and my hope is that someone's reading the book and, you know, it makes their life a little bit easier to get to the goal of whatever it is, if it's a counselor, if it's a principal or a director of a district, you know, whatever it may be. You know, I use Aspire as an acronym to guide, you know, whoever's reading it. And then of course I have like these characteristics that I think every leader should possess. And of course, empathy is one of them. And I talk about restorative practices and really dive into, you know, the different, you know, projects and things that I did on my campus to change the narrative, similar to the conversation we had today.
Well, Josh, I appreciate you sharing that resource. I'll definitely make sure that, you know, all of the different things that you talked about today, you know, they're in the show notes. So I want to say thank you, not just for being right on this show, but thank you for the work that you're doing, especially in the area of restorative practices and trauma-informed, that those are two areas that are near and dear to me. So nice to know, right, that we are out there doing that work.
Yes.
And thank you on a very personal note, just for some of the support that you've provided to me on my educational journey. So I do appreciate you and just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, right back at you, Charles. I am extremely blessed to be in your circle, like I said, and be a part of that Teach Better podcast network. You are doing phenomenal things. And like I said, I'm just so honored to be connected with you. And then, of course, to be on this podcast.
All right. Well, I am sure that we will connect again very, very soon here. But until then, thank you for being on the show, and we'll talk soon. I want to thank you for listening to the Counter Narrative Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to like, subscribe, and of course, share it with friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show, so please leave a comment or two as well. Now, I'm not sure what platform you're using, but the show can be found on Anchor, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and plenty of other platforms. If the show isn't on your preferred site, let me know, and I'll be sure to get it up and running. This podcast is also featured on schoolrubric.com, where you can find educational articles, videos, and interviews with educators from around the globe. Be sure to connect with me and other listeners by following the show on Twitter at the CN Podcast and joining the show's Facebook group. Take care.